I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I, like a lot of people in this town, have seen the photographs of Tamio Wakayama without realizing who took the often stunning photos. He was the longtime photographer of the Powell Street Festival, helping found it and doing many other works of service here in Vancouver, in and around the Japanese-Canadian community and other arts communities. A new documentary shed some light on the life and times of Wakayama, who died in 2018. Between Pictures, The Lens of Tamio Wakayama is the title of the important film by the artist Cindy Mochizuki. In the film, she illuminates the work of Wakayama, whether it's in the midst of the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1960s, or in trips to Japan later on, or back in Vancouver, when he returns to find his roots on the West Coast. He was born in New Westminster in 1941, when he and his family are declared enemy aliens and forced into an internment camp. This experience made him not just sympathetic, but moved to action during the 1960s, when he went to the United States to join SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was an important organization in the civil rights movement. Wakayama arrives and does what he can, like drive people or sweep up. He's soon given a camera and told to document various events like protests and marches. And through SNCC's publication, The Student Voice, photography of what was going on was able to be circulated through the South and throughout the United States. As the film beautifully illustrates through interviews, animation, as well as the beautiful photographs Wakayama took, we see how he reconciles his early experiences with the internment and his own cultural and political identity back in Canada. He's such a unique and remarkable artist that this journey to finding peace with his heritage and his family's history makes the film fascinating and visually stunning. Cindy Mochizuki is a multimedia Japanese-Canadian artist who works in various media like drawings, installations, performance, video works, and film. Visit cindymochizuki.com for more information. The first screening of this film is already sold out, but you know what it's like in this town. If you show up Sunday afternoon at 5 at the Cinematheque, there might be standby tickets. The next showing is next Thursday, May 9th. At 12:30 p.m. at SFU downtown. Visit doxafestival.ca for tickets and information. We taped this interview 1 week ago. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Cindy Mochizuki. Ms. Mochizuki, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. It's such a beautiful film, not just visually, but obviously. Tamio Wakayama's photographs are a marvelous part of that. When you are thinking about making a movie like this, how inspired are you by his own photographs, and does that influence how you frame certain shots as a filmmaker?
Oh, definitely. I think Tamio Wakayama had a really gracious and beautiful way of capturing people's faces. I think when I went through his archive of work, even from the civil rights photographs to the work in Powell Street, I really marveled at his ability to capture the face, the people's spirit, and a person's soul. And I thought that for sure was a key way to kind of frame it. And the film also, it's about him. It's sort of about turning the lens back at him and picturing him again as well. So I was definitely thinking about, a person's identity and a person's face for sure.
Yeah. So you obviously, in this film, talk about his work and the incredible legacy that he's left behind artistically. But you also consider his life, which is a fascinating life itself because it has many facets. The idea that, just talking about his art for a second and the way he captured, because he approaches his work with great compassion. Where do you think that comes from?
I think, and I may be projecting, but I think it comes back to his own Japanese-Canadian identity. Mm. I think it stems from, and he and I have a similar history in that our family, our parents, and he was a small child that went to the internment. So we have the connection of the Japanese-Canadian internment, and that's a history, and we're a community where photography is, it's quite loaded. It's a, before the Japanese-Canadians that went to internment, they had to destroy their cameras. Like, there were no photographs taken. inside the camps, and because of the forced dispersal, many Japanese Canadian families didn't get back to their photo albums or their boxes of photos. So nothing is really there, and unless it's a sort of government-sanctioned photograph that the official archives would have of the camps. And so I think it's having that sensitivity to your own family's history, and your and see, you know, he was a small boy in the internment. So it's about, I think, that empathy and coming out of that history of violence and trauma. And I think gives him that sensitivity and that care to kind of also, you know, to feel comfortable and also to have empathy to work in the South with the Black community as well. So I think that's where it stems from, most definitely.
Yeah, it's one thing to see these photographs on their own. And I've seen some of them before, you know, in other works and the sort online even. And then when you see, when you find out about his story, his background, what he went through, and this journey that he took through, you know, throughout the American South, back to Japan, back to the West Coast, and you see those photographs again, you can't help but see the photos in a different light. And what comes through is his humanity, which you probably wouldn't have seen the first time.
True, yes, for sure. I mean, I personally didn't know Tamio as well as I do now, when he was alive and working in the Palestry. I knew him sort of on the periphery. And I've come across those Palestry photos on their posters, on their postcards, the photograph of Linda Uehara Hoffman as the taiko drummer. You know, you see that image quite often.
Yeah.
And I think it's different now knowing that he witnessed, you know, the American Civil Rights, being in the South, photographing that, what it means to go to Japan, and I think for him it was sort of, as a Japanese Canadian, being there, like, oh, this isn't quite me as well.
Yeah.
You know, this is my ancestry, but this isn't me as well. And then landing into the Palestry, I think it gives strength to the images in a really different way. It gives a different context, I think.
Yeah, somebody in your film says that, trying to find the quote now, he described him as a self-created individual. And you know, I found that such an interesting way to think about him in a powerful way, because here's somebody who was born, I guess he was born in New West, is that right? New Westminster, B.C.?
Yeah, born in New West and then raised Port Hammond.
Yeah.
Port Haney, yeah.
Yeah, and then obviously the time in internment, and then they move east.
Chatham,
Ontario. And then he goes to the South, he goes to Japan, and then he ends up back here in Vancouver. He's taking parts of all of these things, and then that shapes him as he moves on in life, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There are words of his throughout. I mean, we see him in interviews and the sort. There's an interview with Paul Wong that's in your film. But there are his words, and you use a narrator what is that work? Is that a memoir of his that he wrote?
Yeah, he's got an unpublished memoir called Soul on Rice, and his partner Mayu Takasaki allowed for our team to adapt that, and so the animation tether the live action stories, and those are actual words from his memoir and narrated by actor Hito Kanagawa.
How do you choose your narrator?
Gosh. The memoir is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's so well written, and it was difficult. And he actually goes through, I haven't captured every single thing that happened, obviously, in the memoir, but I wanted to really tether and pull through something that would really kind of link the journey from the South, from being in Chatham, going down to the South, to Japan and to the West Coast. And I sort of resat with the text for some time and pulled what could best describe that long, winding journey.
Yeah, and he's an actor, the narrator that you use in the film, that we've seen in things, obviously, over the years. And he adds so much to the words themselves. The words itself, themselves, if one read them, are powerful enough, incredibly powerful. But when you use them in the film, it's something powerful beyond, you know, that one could have imagined.
Yeah, and I think it's also a way to exclaim or have an exclamation point on what the journey meant for him. Because when he wrote this memoir, he's thinking back. So it's a Tamio that's evolved through time and transformed and is able to kind of place language in what he was going through, which would be very different from, his time in the South. He's just trying to stay alive and shoot the photographs and do the work for SNCC. And so I think they have deep resonance because the memoir acted as a kind of a testament to him in his older years looking back. And then in the film, they kind of capture through his words what exactly he went through on that journey.
Yeah, and it's almost in conversation with some of the interviews that you did with people, contemporaries of his, people that he knew.
That's right.
And it really is just effective that way. The other thing you mentioned a moment ago, the animation in the film, and I thought it was such an effective use of animation. Is that work that you did yourself? They're inspired by his work, too, I would assume. Is that right?
So they're hand-painted, illustrated animations by myself and my animation assistant, Cherry Wenwen Liu. And when I worked with my cinematographer, Milena Salazar, there were some sections where we just didn't have pictures or video footage for. So in that way, animation can really lend itself to draw out those stories. And also, he has such a... what I picked up on, he has such a whimsical, light, funny, humorous sense of humor that when you read the memoir, it's there. And he's kind of like, he's going through these really intense journeys, but always with a little wry smile and just kind of laugh. I feel like he's laughing through his journey as well. So animation kind of gave it that lightness. Even the beetle going by, taking the John Lewis and the activist Nick and the beetle down and, across the highway where they almost got hit by the semi-truck coming. And I think it serves a way to bring lightness but also bring imagination to these, like, really wild, other tall tales inside the film.
Even those things that I don't know how to describe those things, these little things at the bottom of the screen that move and that draw your eye to whatever is the next piece. Like, there's one interview where the subject walks into the room, sits down, and then grabs a book, and then you put their name on the screen. But before that, there is this thing that runs across almost. That's such an effective tool in terms of drawing the eye to the subject. But at the same time, it also... reflects Tamio's, as you just said a moment ago, his sense of humor, and that made the film almost more enjoyable than I thought it would, because it is very dark in some places, and yet I don't think he, in retrospect, if he were here with us today, would think in telling the story he wouldn't be as dark, I guess, in his telling, right?
I feel like he would be a bit of a jokester, or he'd have a sly smile. And I think, it comes across also in the interviewees, they all have a soft spot for him. They're all, like, I think Judy Richardson was like, he comes out of the dark room and he's like a caveman, and he had a sense of joy about him. And so those little touches, like the beetle running across the bottom, I think all those things, point to his sense of humor and lightness.
Indeed, the journey from because he's in Chatham, Ontario. Sorry, Cindy, my mic just died again. I got to mark the timer because I got to cut this out. The journey that he takes from Chatham, Ontario, and I'd forgotten that was the end point of the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. From there to the United States, at the height of the civil rights movement, this is in the 60s, that's a remarkable story itself. And he's inspired to go down because he's watching it on television, isn't he? And he's seeing all this happen. Mm-hmm. And he wants to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as we learn later in the film, he's quite humbled by the part he played in it. And it does affect him a great deal, doesn't it? I mean, it shapes his life and the way that he sees the world, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he watches the lunch counter sit-in, and he sees the black and white students being, you know, with Coca-Cola poured on them and eggs being tossed at them. And he finds a kind of, I guess, kinship or a kind of, he relates to that. And I think he had been done with university, didn't want to stay there, joins, heads down south in his beetle and shows up kind of at the right time, at the right moment, joins the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and then he starts out as a janitor and sweeping the floor of the office, and because he comes with this VW Beetle, he can drive the activists around and this sort of thing, and then ends up doing, I guess, graphic design and poster making, and is eventually passed a camera to try darkroom photography. Sorry, and so the question you would ask.
Yeah, the other thing that's remarkable that's said in the film is how fast he works, because they have to. Yeah. He goes to these events where you know there's a violence at times.
Yeah.
He has to take these pictures, develop them himself. He has to rush them so that they get published in their newsletter.
Yeah,
he's working very fast in these days, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's not like our times where we have this iPhone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like you've got to set up your shot. You know, take it, try not to get killed, and get back to the darkroom, develop it by hand, right? And then and get it into the student voice.
Yeah, and
it's a really different time than how we just snap photos on our iPhone and we could just text it, right?
Indeed. And it's so effective, too, isn't it? Because once it gets published, this lights a fire in a lot of people's...
It goes out to other parts of the United States so people know what's actually happening down there.
So after this time in the United States, he visits Japan for the first time. Does he have an idea of what he wanted to get out of that trip, say? Or
He's received a Canada Council grant to go to Japan. And I think the more he talks about, you know, he's going to go on this pilgrimage. He sort of has this romanticized idea that it's going to be this great pilgrimage.
Yeah.
He's going to head down to Fukuoka-ken, to Shida-machi, where his ancestors are from, and meet a sister. I think there's a sister there as well. And it's kind of similar to what Paul Wong says in his interview, where he makes that trip back to China and comes back with more questions than answers, right?
Yeah.
And so I think he had an idea of what it might be, and then also kind of being in this state of like lost in translation. It's not quite me, but it is me, but it's not quite me. And when you look at the photographs are beautiful in the Japan section.
Uh-huh.
And it's sort of still, I think, him sort of on the periphery looking out to the people in the field, the kids on the bicycles, this sort of thing, but not quite fitting in.
Yeah, and I guess that he takes this back to Canada, and he works through what he needs to work through, doesn't he? In terms of, he finds some peace, doesn't he? That I don't know if he wanted, or that he realized he needed.
Yeah, and I think many of the interviewees kind of say that where the South gave him the courage to look back and kind of flip the lens inward. Himself and to address, you know, his family's history, his own identity that he couldn't look at, couldn't face, and couldn't look at. And then, you know, be in Japan, come back to the West Coast and meet this sort of group of Japanese and Japanese Canadian artists and activists. And I think with that group of individuals, feel like, oh, it's okay to celebrate our Japanese-ness or Japanese-Canadian-ness. It's okay to publicly be visible and build this festival. And I think in part the South gave him that strength to do that.
And this is a section in your film where you talk about Powell Street, and not just the history of it prior to the Second World War, and before that through to... what it is today, and the Powell Street Festival, which is such an important part of the year in this city. And how much a part he was of that in capturing its history. I mean, it's been going on for a number of years now, and he was there from the beginning, wasn't he, with his camera and documenting it, right?
That's right, yeah. I think he's one of the, I think he might be the only, one of the only or one of the few artists that photograph the festival every year. He was the Powell Street photographer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that we take for granted nowadays because we all have iPhones. In those days, you needed someone like that, right? And it's such a gift, isn't it, to look back at some of those. I'm sure you were floored by some of the photos that you got to see over the course of making the film.
Yeah, I mean, there's some that I know that are iconic about Powell Street, and then there were these other ones that I was like, oh, I didn't even know these existed, and I didn't, you know. And he's just able to be, as a photographer, I think, get in and navigate through those crowds and find these really great moments, again, of people. And I'm sure he's captured some of the, you say, generation or the, you know, the elders in our community that might have passed now. So it's a testament to different generations attending and all that. But just, yeah, really beautiful photographs.
Your film, Cindy, begins at his home. And we see his partner. At the beginning of the movie, sort of walk us through the home. She plays a very important part in the making of the film, doesn't she, in terms
That's
of encouraging
right.
you, right?
Yeah, she obviously gave us the consent to make the film and integrate his unpublished memoir and was readily there for us as a force also through the last 3 years of making this.
Yeah.
She didn't want to be in the film, as per se, but we thought, in hindsight, we thought about it and thought it would just be a nice way to kind of cap the film where it begins, you know, going to his home where Union Street, where there's also his film, the place where he did his darkroom photography, and begin there by looking at the portfolios of work. And then, you know, the film ends there as well.
Yeah. So the house itself is still as it was?
Yeah, I think yes, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. For people who are listening who haven't seen the film yet, when they see the film, they'll understand this next question. There's an Etch-a-Sketch near the end of the film. Is that his work or is that yours?
No, I think a dear friend of theirs made that. Isn't it great?
It's amazing. When I saw that in the film, I had to watch it again last night, and it's such an amazing thing to see on the wall there that you think it's you know but someone who's able to do that, because I had that as a kid and I
know, but that's a detailed portraiture of him in his garden, I think. Right?
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, so it is still on the wall there. Is that right?
Is, yeah.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Cindy, I'm sure you'll be asked this a lot. You know, young people will see this film, and I'm wondering what you hope they get out of the life of Tamio Wakayama in terms of finding inspiration in his example.
Yeah, I hope that people, you know, walk away from looking at the film and thinking, you know, because Tamio, when he started the journey, was in his 20s, right, and kind of didn't know what he was doing and what he was getting into, but then comes out the other side doing this work. So it's, I think, a story where for a younger audience member or a younger person to kind of, you know, to follow the path, stick to your journey, you know, take risks and, you know, explore, especially if you're a younger artist, to find your medium that gives you your voice and, you know, coming out the other side and kind of being able to tether the points together to kind of build your own identity as an artist and tell these stories.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, when he's described as a self-created individual, you know, that can have two different meanings, you know, in terms you know, you can create yourself as you'd like, but to do something in service of other people and a larger community in finding what you're able to do. I mean, you know, he had a particular skill in photography, but that was not, you know, when he goes to SNCC for the first time, that's not how they, you know, that's not the first thing that he does there, right? that he's able to do that in his life and throughout his life. Because, I mean, you've talked to everybody associated with his life that you could. He had that all the time, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he, you mean the photographer?
Yeah, he had that ability to do what he needed to do at a particular time.
Yeah, I think he had the ability to do what he needed to do and also show up for others.
Yeah.
Even if it's like, you know, he started out as the janitor of SNCC, the driver of SNCC. He wasn't the photographer from the get-go. But then all those small moments added up to him learning his craft and being really good at it. And so you never know where you end up. And the small things that you do kind of also add up to kind of your larger purpose in life, I think.
Yeah. Well, you've done a marvelous job in terms of capturing this life story, this remarkable life story. But at the same time, you've made a beautiful film, not just the animation, but even just shots in terms of, you know, in between, throughout the film that are just beautiful. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with everything else. I so appreciate your time
tonight,
Cindy. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The website for more is at cindymochizuki.com. The first screening of Between Pictures, The Lens of Tamio Wakayama is sold out. That's Sunday afternoon, 5 p.m. at the Cinematheque. The next showing is Thursday, the 9th of May, 12:30 p.m. at SFU downtown. Visit doxafestival.ca for tickets and information. The documentary's filmmaker, Cindy Mochizuki, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunter.